Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. The weeks surrounding the holidays get busy, and so does the airport.
Old Christmas trees find new lives in landfills.
Garfield County Sheriff's Office is reporting a hike in phone scams.
The Forest Service wants to sell property to get out of the red.
We look at how online shopping affects local sales tax revenues.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
The Garfield County Sheriff's Office is reporting a hike in phone scams. Their advice to the public is to stay calm and carry on.
The scammers will say they're from the sheriff's office or the IRS. They often use the real names of officers or government employees. If you're contacted by a scammer, the story might go something like this. You owe money for something, late taxes, a loan, a car payment, and if you don't pay them right then and there, there will be consequences, like an increase in fine. Officials say don't believe them. The scammers often work on weekends in order to make it harder for victims to call government offices and verify the scammers' claims.
A busy holiday season in Aspen had more people than ever moving through the airport. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports.
Airport Director John Kinney says the airport saw more traffic on all fronts, including the number of flights, passengers, and rental car customers. There are 40 flights per day for peak season, which runs from mid-December through the third week in January. Monday, all commercial flights were at capacity, which Kinney estimates means about 5,600 passengers moving through the terminal. Real-time numbers of private plane traffic are not available, but Kinney says annually, private operations outnumber commercial by a ratio of 15 to 1. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
The city of Aspen is beginning the official review process to develop a 37,000-square-foot building near Rio Grande Park.
Detailed plans for the Civic Plaza go before the Planning and Zoning Commission tonight for a major public project review. The City Council-appointed volunteer board will be looking to ensure that the proposal complies with land use codes. The commission will also consider merging the three city-owned lots that encompass the parking garage, the Chamber of Commerce offices, and the building housing the restaurant Tasters, into a single legal property. The review begins today at 4:30 in City Hall.
A century-old tradition continued in Aspen this past weekend.
The National Audubon Society has been overseeing Christmas bird counts for 117 years, the longest-running citizen science program in the world. The local count begins Saturday morning at Hallam Lake, where Aspen Center for Environmental Studies bird guide Rebecca Weiss will set the parameters so that the Audubon can effectively use the data. Celebrity birders will be on hand, including Al Levitin, a local resident whose story inspired the movie The Big Year. Weiss says it's a nice holiday tradition to spend time outdoors with the family. Snowmass ski patrollers also participate by sending in count numbers from the top of the mountains as they make their morning safety sweeps.
Christmas trees that have passed their prime may see another life in area landfills. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy reports.
Christmas trees can be used for mulch, daily cover of the landfill, and in some cases as compost. Roaring Fork Valley residents can drop off trees for free at the Rio Grande Recycling Center or the Picken County Landfill until Valentine's Day. Those trees will be ground up and used for compost. In Eagle County, trees are mulched free of charge until late February, and in Garfield County, tree chips are used to cover the landfill at night. Holy Cross Energy also offers cash for recycling working holiday lights at $2 a strand. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy from the Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Tucked away on the far east side of town is one of the largest commercial developments Aspen has seen in quite a while. The overhaul of the Aspen Club and the construction of a new wellness campus is an $80 million project. Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Zachariasen walked the site with club owner Michael Fox, who gives us this update.
So tell us where we're at with the progress.
So we are actually about halfway through construction at this point. We've made great progress this fall. You know, officially broke ground about a year ago. We spent a lot of time with some infrastructure work we were doing, specifically geothermal wells. And now they're all in. And we've been coming out of the ground for about the last 5 months.
You're hoping for a grand opening of?
About 11 months from now. All right, you ready to be wowed? You can see on the first pod of residences, we're almost under roof on all of them. Got the first three residences under roof. We're almost done starting to work on the second floor, on the second pod. You know, the great space of the club's been fully demoed and is ready to start building back up. And then we're starting to demo some of the peripheral spaces around the club.
Right.
So you've got residences, hotel rooms on both sides. And so we're really developing a campus here. You know, you've got this, you know, unbelievable setting. And you look out here, you're looking straight at the river, you know, from the residences. We're utilizing the whole site finally with all the great programming at the Aspen Club, the classes, the nutritionists, the doctors, the physical therapists, the sports medicine experts. There's really nothing like it in the country.
Talk to me a little bit about the programming.
It'll be one of the great programming centers in the world, focused on health and well-being and performance and fun and excitement. I mean, if you think of the Aspen Institute on one side of town, the Aspen Club's going to anchor the other side of town with really cool, unique things that bring people to Aspen. You know, how do people live exceptional lives? How do people, you know, live in a multi-generational world? It's a holistic center for performance and excellence. So we think of it in four key areas. You know, one is how we move, how we exercise. The one is how we breathe. You know, meditation, mindfulness, yoga, you know, preparing mentally, instilling the body. The third is how we eat. You know, how do we eat healthy food and yet enjoyable foods? And the fourth is how we connect. You know, what we're creating here is a campus for the community. You know, we've got the community of Aspen as a base for everything we do.
That was Michael Fox, owner of the Aspen Club. He gave Carolyn Zachariasen a tour of the construction project that will one day become a new campus for health and wellness.
The last day to formally challenge the City of Aspen's conditional water rights on Maroon and Castle Creeks was December 31st. As Elizabeth Stewart Savory reports, at least 10 people and organizations are opposing the city in court.
The city will defend itself in water court against other government agencies, environmental organizations, and private landowners. Pitkin County and the U.S. Forest Service both filed in opposition late last week. Environmental heavy hitters include American Rivers, Wilderness Workshop, and Western Resource Advocates, and at least four wealthy landowners have also filed challenges. The cases will be reviewed by a water referee in upcoming months, and the entire process could take years. Elizabeth Stewart Savory, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram, Aspen Public Radio. Your news, your music, your station.
Shoppers now pay Colorado sales tax when they buy stuff online. This is great news for the state. It captures some of the revenue from internet shopping. The money is still out of reach for cities and towns, though. Wyatt reports that this has some local officials casting a concerned eye toward the future.
Shopping online is easy and it's cheap, and Frosty Marriott knows this. He's on the board of trustees in Carbondale. One reason it's cheap...
There's no state sales tax, no Carbondale sales tax, no Garfield County, no Rafta, no nothing. So it's a pretty good deal for people to buy online.
This recently changed at the state level. The Supreme Court in December refused to hear an appeal regarding the Amazon tax, which forces online retailers to collect Colorado's sales tax. And it's serious money. We're talking about nearly 3% of online transactions. Some estimate Colorado's losses topped $170 million each year because of unrecovered sales tax revenue from online shopping.
But clearly, municipalities are still not even in the mix.
Dan Richardson is Carbondale's mayor. Sales tax fills up the town's general fund, along with oil and gas revenue, which is way down. It's places like City Market, the Roaring Fork Co-op, and liquor stores that generate the most sales tax for the town. Nonetheless, online purchases are a revenue source, and one that's frustratingly out of reach. The quandary was mentioned at the last trustee meeting. Here's Marriott.
I don't know why we couldn't piggyback on the state sales tax.
Marriott wants Amazon to collect local sales tax, too. And this won't happen unless towns like Carbondale join together and lobby at the state capitol.
I feel like I definitely have had a presence in the valley.
On Main Street in Carbondale, Harmony Scott's local jewelry business benefits plenty from online sales. She ships all over.
New York, California, Dallas, all over the country.
The majority of her sales still come from the store. That said, if she had to calculate state and local taxes for everywhere she sends her jewelry, the amount of paperwork and time would be, quote, horrible. This could become the reality if officials act on their concern, because if the state is entitled to sales tax, why wouldn't towns and cities be too?
Republican Kevin Grantham will lead the state Senate next session. His party held on to its one-seat majority in that chamber. He'd previously focused on budget issues. He comes from Canyon City and says he's the first rural Senate president in more than four decades. Capitol correspondent Benta Berkland sat down with Grantham.
This is your first session as Senate president. Talk about some of your overall goals coming into this session personally.
Several things on our agenda that we'd like to accomplish. Probably first and foremost would be some reform on the construction litigation problems that we've seen develop over the last few years here in Colorado. And I think we actually have a realistic chance of getting something passed unlike the last couple of years. So,
has something changed, or do you think lawmakers have just learned from the failed attempts?
Both. And we have certainly run into some issues with prior legislation that we're trying to address. But other things have also changed, including leadership in the House.
I know with construction defects, it's to spur development of new building. Do you see this mainly as a Denver area bill?
Not necessarily. Actually, we see builders across the state on this grand scale of things. Certainly Denver actually has the most problems with affordable housing, and so it will probably see the most benefit from reform like this. But this isn't something that will not benefit rural Colorado. In fact, there are builders out in rural Colorado that are excited about some of these changes because, like anybody even here, the big developers in Denver, the little guy out in rural Colorado has trouble affording those insurance rates just as much as the guys here in the big city.
Republicans have a one-seat majority in the Senate. Does that change how you govern when it is so narrow? And as you know, nationally, we have a divided country coming off the presidential race.
It's on a case-by-case basis. You know, it depends on the issue, it depends on the circumstances, and it depends on who's on which side of which issues.
When Trump won the nomination, you at the time said you didn't trust that he was truly conservative and you weren't that pleased with him being the nominee. Now he is going to be the president. Are there certain things you're going to be specifically looking at to see from him? And do you think anything will impact what happens during the session?
You know, even back then, I was always hopeful that he was every bit as conservative as people thought he was. And from what I've seen so far on some of his appointments, I'm even more hopeful and optimistic over what a Trump presidency will look like.
It sounds like energy will be a big focus with, I know, the minority party in your chamber has appointed kind of an energy czar, and then your party has a select committee on energy.
The select committee on energy will focus on many of these issues when it comes to what's happening in D.C. and some of the changes that we might be seeing coming from there, how we can respond to those effectively during the 120-day session.
You'd previously served on the Joint Budget Committee. What do you see as the biggest budget challenges coming into this session?
Well, the biggest budget challenge is the ever-increasing amount that we're having to pay on Medicaid and for the expansions. It's cutting into some of our other, what we feel are necessary functions of government, including transportation infrastructure. That's going to be another one of our main focuses. We're hopeful, actually, to find that solution this year, and it will be a multifaceted solution if we were able to get it done before the middle of May.
Would you consider referring something to voters and letting voters decide whether they'd want to raise the gas tax or come up with some other revenue stream?
If there is going to be a long-term solution to transportation infrastructure, it's going to almost certainly require something that the voters are going to have to weigh in on. What that is, what that looks like, we're still talking about, and we'll continue to address right up to the session and through the session. But what that looks like, I'm not sure, but almost certainly it will be something that the voters will get to weigh in on.
That was Senate President-elect Kevin Grantham from Canyon City. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
The U.S. Forest Service has taken initial steps to sell two properties totaling about 70 acres adjacent to Crown Mountain Park and the Roaring Fork River in the Mid-Valley. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, the move comes as the agency works to reduce costs amid funding cuts.
Mark Duff frequently takes his high school classes to a small wetland area on the Roaring Fork River. They study water chemistry, ecology, and nature writing. This spot, he says, is perfect to pair science and personal experience. Plus, it's public land that's close to school and easy to access.
You know, these little postage stamp-sized chunks of land that are close to where people live have a lot of value.
And the U.S. Forest Service is poised to find out just how much value. The agency hopes to sell the 40-acre riverside property, along with a 30-acre lot in El Jebel at the old tree farm site. Both are labeled administrative parcels, and Forest Supervisor Scott Fitzwilliam says their sale would provide much-needed funding.
We're absolutely struggling to survive financially.
Congress has cut the Forest Service budget by about 58% in the past decade, and Fitzwilliam says there are virtually no funds available for capital improvements, like the needed repairs to the bunkhouse in Aspen and the district office in Carbondale. In this financial desert, Fitzgerald says, the agency can't take care of properties like the one in El Jebel that has several dated homes on it that are used for Forest Service employee housing.
We have 2.5 million acres to steward and maintain. Being a landlord and a property manager for multiple single-family homes is a burden we can no longer afford.
Selling off administrative lands like this is part of a larger strategy to simplify the Forest Service budget as it shrinks. Fitzwilliam says the goal is to oversee fewer facilities so that the little money the agency does have might go a bit further. But the riverside property that the Forest Service is considering selling takes some unique consideration. All of those characteristics that make it an ideal spot for learning about both science and what nature does for the human soul should matter, says teacher Mark Duff.
The intrinsic value of these chunks of land are greater than the extrinsic value with the almighty dollar and all that.
And Fitzwilliams agrees that the riparian area does warrant special attention.
The ecological resources will be protected and it'll remain open to the public. Those two things will happen or we won't sell it.
Those protections could take several forms, including a conservation easement or management by a local open space program. Elizabeth Stewart Severy from the Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
You are listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bektesh. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Also online, you can sign up for Aspen Public Radio's new Fork-Fed digital newsletter. ForkFed comes out every Friday, updating you on the week's news in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond.
Democrat Chrisanta Duran will serve as the top lawmaker in the State House of Representatives next session, leading the 65-member chamber as the Speaker of the House. She will also be the first Latina to serve in that role in state history. Capitol correspondent Benta Berkland sat down with her to talk about what's going to get done this year.
You are the first Latina speaker. How does that play into your perspective and how you approach things?
It is a great honor to have been elected by my colleagues to serve as the next Speaker of the House. And in going forward in this upcoming legislative session, we are going to be focused on making sure that we always put people first. We want the Colorado House Democrats to stand for not taking any Coloradans for granted and not leaving any Coloradans behind. And so I'm hopeful that the upcoming legislative session will be one that's productive.
Do you feel that that's something your party needs to work on coming out of this presidential race where a lot of people who voted for Trump said they did feel left behind?
Well, Colorado House Democrats actually had great advancements this last election. We went from 34 seats to 37 seats. And I think that's representative of the fact that we have leaders from all areas of Colorado that listen to their constituents and deliver results to the issues that people deal with every day.
We're not going into a big election year this session. So do you think of something substantive and some big policy solution both sides can agree on is going to happen, it'll happen this session.
Well, the budget is in a very challenging position, and we need to make sure that we're adequately investing in education and also transportation. With so much growth to the state and economic activity that we've seen here, we need to ensure that we invest in our roads and bridges and infrastructure, and that we think about how we organize our roads, not just to move cars, but also people. And that's why prior to the election, I convened a group of legislators in leadership to start talking about transportation funding specifically. I'm hopeful that we will be able to come up with a statewide transportation plan this session.
Is that something you think will be part of the budget? Or could we possibly refer something to voters for instance, raising the gas tax?
We're putting all options on the table because we have to look at a variety of ways to address our budget issues. The last two sessions, Democrats came forward with changing the hospital provider fee into an enterprise, which would have freed up hundreds of millions of dollars under the Tabor cap to invest in education and transportation. That's something that we're still interested in, but we also have to recognize that that would have been a Band-Aid to a larger budget issue. And that's why we've convened this group of Republicans and Democrats to figure out what can we do long-term in the state of Colorado to address our transportation needs. I feel very strongly and felt this before the election, that regardless of who won or lost on election day, to be able to do this effectively, we have to have everyone at the table and have Republicans and Democrats working together. We're continuing those conversations, and we're looking at a variety of different options.
You served on the Joint Budget Committee. What do you see as the biggest budget challenge lawmakers will have to grapple with this session?
One area in particular that I think we have to continue some of the good work that we've done before is making sure that the people of Colorado have tools to succeed, get good paying jobs. We should be thinking always about how we invest in local workers and local businesses. And specifically, right now there are jobs in Colorado in the technology industry that are not being fulfilled, and particularly areas like computer science and digital literacy. Only 1 in 4 Colorado students have access to computer science or digital literacy classes. We need to do more to make sure that those options are available for students. As we have a changing economy, we need to make sure everyone has tools to succeed, to be able to provide for themselves and for their families.
It's hard to predict with a Trump presidency, but how much do you think you, as the Democratic leader in the State House, will have to respond to what's happening nationally?
Well, we're going to focus on being as productive as possible in Colorado. I do think we have a tradition of Republicans and Democrats coming together. That said, I will stand strong against any actions that can hurt Colorado families. And we need to make sure that we focus on always putting people first.
Thanks. We appreciate you taking the time. That's incoming Speaker of the House, Chrisanta Duran. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
Earlier this week, Garfield County renewed a contract with a consulting firm to audit the local oil and gas industry. The county has good reason to think it's a worthwhile investment.
Garfield County will pay Martindale Consultants $100,000 to audit two of the energy companies working within the county, Encana and Williams. These audits are routine. The goal is to make sure the county is getting the taxes they're owed. Energy companies self-report the taxes they owe. Since 2008, Martindale has recovered over $19 million in unpaid taxes from the oil and gas industry.
Republican Patrick Neville is only serving his second term in office, but he recently rose to the highest position in his caucus, House Minority Leader. Neville's selection comes as a surprise. Polly Lawrence, who has served in the legislature since 2012, was considered the favorite for the position. Capitol correspondent Benta Berkland got Neville's thoughts on his new role.
You've served in the State House for one session, and you weren't the heir apparent for this position. I think we thought it would be someone who was in leadership. Talk about your sales pitch to your caucus and why you wanted to take on this role.
We really need to highlight who we are. I think we need to be bold as Republicans and show the people who we really are. And that's really to be champions of the people. Our goal is to empower the people. Right now, I think we're in a state where the government has really gotten too large, and it's gotten into every aspect of people's lives. And we really want to pull that back so that people are making more decisions for themselves. I would rather see more decisions made at the kitchen tables of families rather than under the gold dome here at the Capitol.
You'd be happy if fewer bills were passed each session.
One way to judge a session is a lot of people will judge it, look how many bills are passed. I think we should look at the quality of the different bills. Simply passing a bill, even if it has great intentions, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a great bill. There might be unintended consequences resulting from that. So we need to take a look at it. And really, I think everything we should be doing is trying to empower the citizens of the state to make decisions for themselves, for their own businesses, so they can grow and prosper.
Do the results of the presidential election and a divided country change or influence how you'll approach this upcoming session?
Not too much. I do think we need to look at what changes are going to be made at the federal level. And according to what changes are made at the federal level, if we have a good opportunity to maybe make some adjustments, like in the healthcare arena, we need to be ready and be on our toes so that we're not stuck and locked into these high prices and this current situation that we have.
Your party lost seats in the House, even though nationally it's very good for Republicans. Is that part of what you were talking about with messaging to voters?
I don't know if we need to do anything exactly differently. I did take this role with the idea that we were going to be bold and that we were going to show who we are. We can't just simply say over and over that we're not the other side of the aisle. We have to show what we stand for and show how we are actually going to be better for the citizens of Colorado.
For policy issues, what do you think are going to be your caucus's priorities?
Well, I think we do have to take a look at housing. The fact of the matter is, in the housing market in Colorado, we've seen owner-occupied multifamily housing go down from less than 5% of the market, and that's the current situation. So we do need to take a look at that, and so we can actually start getting some of these projects built again and get the government out of the way in a lot of those areas. And litigation reform, I think we have to take a look at it so these housing projects actually start getting built again, so these people actually have, the consumers have a product to consume. Another thing, like I said earlier, is the regulatory reform. The average small business owner doesn't realize that these rules are being passed or they're being placed on them until afterwards. So we have to find a system that actually takes a look at the cost-benefit analysis of these rules before they're passed. Transportation funding, I think we need to take a deep look at that, because we keep saying under the Gold Dome that this is a top priority, yet it's not a priority in the general fund. Our one discretionary pot, we have not made it a priority. And it's my goal that we show the citizens that it is a priority, and we start looking at all the projects in the general fund. And if transportation is our number one top priority, let's show the citizens it is, and let's actually fund some of it through the general fund.
For you, are you feeling pretty optimistic about the future of Colorado and how the path the state's on?
I am. I'm very optimistic. Colorado's been a traditionally libertarian-leaning state, and that's actually, philosophically, that's how I lean. I'm very look at it, I think, with limited government type of focus, and I think that's how most Colorado citizens actually are. And so I think if we can actually move forward on that message and reduce some of the size and scope and burdens on the citizens of Colorado, Coloradans will flourish.
How much of your role is looking to the next election cycle and gaining seats? And if that happened, you guys could have the majority in both chambers.
Well, I think right now we got to look at governing. So I think if we actually show that we are the message that resonates with the Coloradans, that might have an effect in the next election cycle and actually be in a position where we can influence and make Coloradans' lives better.
We're out of time. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was House Minority Leader Patrick Neville. I'm Benta Berkland in Denver.
The first of three open houses hosted by the developers of Aspen's new affordable housing complexes happens this afternoon.
New properties will be built on West Main Street, Park Circle, and Castle Creek Drive. Today's open house will reveal the conceptual architectural drawings for each parcel. Attendees will receive a questionnaire asking for input regarding factors such as what income levels should be served by the units and how the building should fit into their surrounding neighborhoods. The open house is today from 4 to 7 at the Limelight. Project developers Aspen Housing Partners will present the public feedback to City Council in February.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.